Welcome to Books Over Bars, a break free education podcast highlighting the incredible work taking place in juvenile justice classrooms across the country. In this first ever episode of Books Over Bars, we are getting started with a tech series focusing on accessible technology in secure schools. We're going to introduce our hosts of this tech series, dive into tips for getting those devices ready to start a new school year, and introduce Breakfree's brand new online community, Breakfree Base. I'm one of your hosts, Kayla Holland. I'm the Director of Instructional Technology and Blended Learning for Breakfree Education. And for this tech series, I'm joined by my good friend and tech guru, Anthony Martini. Hi, Anthony.
How's it going, Kayla?
Good. I am so glad you're co-hosting this tech series with me. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I will certainly do so. I'm very glad to be participating as well. I'm an entrepreneur, technology consultant, and I'm co-owner of Logic Wing, an IT services company serving schools across the U.S. And I've been partnering with Break Free for over 8 years to help implement tech into juvenile justice education programs. In fact, I've been partnering with Break Free so long that it wasn't even called Break Free when I started working with you.
That's right. Do you remember what it was called?
I remember CEAS or something like that.
CEEAS, I think. There you go. People decided how to pronounce that acronym many different ways, but it was the Center for Educational Excellence in Alternative Settings. Yeah. And then about 4 years ago, I think, we officially changed to Break Free Education. And I like the name.
I can't believe it's that long ago either. 4 years ago, the name changed.
I know. So I'm really excited we're doing this tech series. And I think this kind of has come out of you and I leading a monthly group for tech specialists, tech experts, I think is what I kind of call them. And I think it's a really good idea to start with how you and I got into technology, because I don't know that we've really ever had that conversation or really ever shared that with the folks in our tech specialist group. So how about we start there? How did you get into the educational technology field?
Yeah, so many, many years ago, I was working for a paging company, believe it or not, PageNet, when pagers were a thing, before everybody had a cell phone.
Okay.
And
I really was going to say, do you really mean pagers? But you do.
Oh, I do.
Wow, okay.
I tended to be the person in the office that when there was a problem with the computers or the servers, I would get a call from the IT folks at headquarters in Texas, and I'd be in New York in the office, and I'd be rebooting servers or applying updates to workstations. And my interest in technology just grew from there. Eventually, I got a job with a small IT consulting company, and then was involved with several school districts. And so I was working 60 hours a week supporting educators with technology and, you know, in all sorts of technological capacities, you know, server admin, network admin, implementing wireless networks, voice over IP, et cetera. So kind of taste of everything, but I really got deeply involved in what technology support was like for schools.
That's really interesting. Mine was a very different route. I started as a 10th grade English teacher and really was just trying to find a way to engage students. And we were given devices at this school that year and nobody really knew how to use them. And my kids seemed to be really unengaged and unmotivated in the classroom. And so I was a young teacher at the time. This was my first year teaching. And I just started using, I think it was Edmodo at the time. Do you remember Edmodo?
Yes, I do. Absolutely.
I think that's what it was called. Or it might have been Edline. I don't know. It's many, many years ago now. But it was this kind of classroom website before blogs and Google sites were kind of a thing. And right. I just started creating something for students to do digitally. And the director of tech came to me one day and said, hey, I think what you're doing in your classroom is pretty cool. Do you want to show some other teachers what you're doing? Now, I was like 22 at the time, literally had just graduated and had been teaching for 6 months. And, you know,
the young teacher in the youngest teacher in the building, nobody really wants to listen to. But I said, sure, of course, I'll show people what I'm doing. And I realized I really love it. I loved training adults. And we didn't have a tech coach. I think that's what we call them now, an instructional tech coach. The school I was working in at the time didn't have that role. So they kind of created it and said, do you want to take on this role? And I did. And I've joked with you before about having a cloffice, right? Like a closet and an office together. So they basically just cleaned out a storage office, a closet, and said, here's your office, Kayla. have a great year. But I like to say that I was Google taught because I don't have a tech background. I didn't when I started. I kind of do now, but everything I learned about imaging computers and infrastructures and networks was literally just Googling my heart out to try and problem solve in the moment. So I started as a tech coach.
Big secret in tech is that a lot of tech folks do that, Kayla. So
yeah, they do.
That's
and
legit.
I was that role in multiple different schools for about 10 or 12 years. Tech facilitator, tech coach, there's many different names, but I'm really still passionate about helping people in that specific role because it's really isolating.
How many people do you think you've trained at this point in your life? How many teachers?
Oh, that's such an interesting question.
Right?
I mean, that sounds like a big number, but yeah, because I've worked in so many different environments, you know, several hundred at each school or something like that. And then now with Break Free, we support, you know, hundreds to thousands of teachers across the country, depending on the kind of work we're doing. So yeah, I'd say thousands. That's a sobering thought.
I know.
Hopefully they've been good trainings and good workshops, making real change in the world, but you never know. So talking about like training, we're here today for your tech guru mind to give us some tips for what do we do to get the school year started. And I know, like I typically say the school year, and I know our juvenile justice spaces, they're really more year round, but we do kind of have a general like kickoff in August where maybe teachers have had some time off in the summer and they're coming back, or there's just this general feeling of like school's getting started in August and ends in May, and then there's some summer programming. So if we're getting the school year started, that traditional school setup in August, what are some tips you have?
Sure. And by no means is this an exhaustive list, because we can make a list of dozens of things.
Oh, yeah.
But,
we'd be here all day.
We'll highlight some of the, what I think, the more critical issues that would be important for you to take a look at when you're responsible for technology in your facility. So one of the kind of things that's inherent in cloud solutions like Google, Microsoft, and you know other solutions that you may be using in your facility is that because they're cloud-based, they update really frequently. So I think it's important to review any recent updates to kind of the cornerstone applications that your students and teachers are utilizing, like Google Workspace or Microsoft 365 or any learning management systems, content filters, even down to operating systems like Chrome OS, Windows, and Mac OS, because there are so many frequent updates, and some of the updates could be, you know, pretty relevant to changes in workflow, right? To how things might change for your users.
Yeah. So when you're saying mm-hmm. recent, like how often, if I'm I like the term techspert, right? It blends the word tech with expert because there's so many different titles. But if I'm a techspert in a facility, how often am I reviewing some of these recent updates? Is that monthly? Is that quarterly? What is the best plan?
Again, you know, just to call out, you know, Microsoft and Google, right? They are releasing updates on a monthly basis. So it's something that you can visit their blogs. They both maintain blogs where they post the updates to their products. And they go into a fair amount of detail about, you know, what those changes are and how they might affect your end users from a technology standpoint, like as an administrator. As far as the other programs, you know, a learning management system or a content filter, they might not have as frequent updates as Google and Microsoft have. But again, I would closely follow, you know, whatever documentation comes from the vendor, sign up for newsletters, to get alerts for changes in systems and updates. And of course, when you can, after you've reviewed the updates, then if necessary, you might have to actually apply them, right? They might not always be automatic. So.
Right. Yeah. Because a lot of times, like I get a lot of emails from Google and Microsoft and different types of learning management systems saying like our terms are changing or this new policy is coming out, or especially Google Workspace for Education, you know, here's the 15 things that are being updated in August. And so it sounds like you kind of have to be looking through that list on a pretty regular basis and deciding this policy change affects my students and I'm going to make that policy change in my admin console, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, the regular rhythm of a school year, which doesn't always apply to juvenile justice education programs, you know, for more traditional school environments, you know, the summertime is usually, you know, teachers are out of the classroom, students are at home, but IT is hard at work normally. And Google and Microsoft usually drop, you know, any number of huge updates at the end of June. You know, usually around ISTE as a technology conference. So, you know, when you're coming back in late August, these updates might be pretty substantial compared to how they, you know, the norm.
Yeah. And I know, like, even though, you know, again, this is our juvenile justice spaces, you know, summer programming is still happening in a lot of these places over the summer, but our typical kind of school day feel is, you know, alternated some in the summer. So if you are a tech expert in one of these facilities, the summer is still a good time for you to get into the facility and make some of these changes. But a lot of these can be done without touching physical devices. It can be done on your web browser from your computer. Like I'm thinking the Google Admin Console. If you have a learning management system like Hopera or GoGuardian, there's a web-based, cloud-based admin console for all of those. So for a lot of these, you're monitoring them and you're really not having to touch each device, right?
Absolutely true. And the other thing to consider is that you might have multiple admins for these systems. So it's a good opportunity to, you know, meet with those other admins and again, make those decisions and also pull in any stakeholders that it might have, you know, an effect on. So those instructional folks who, you know, may need to understand how those changes might affect what they're planning for the school year.
Yeah. And I think that's a big piece because a lot of times that piece gets left out. So our tech experts make changes and nobody really tells the educators in the classroom. And that's why I love the role of a tech coach that I played for 10 to 12 years, because I felt like that role was a liaison between the two. I understand the educational language, but I also understand the tech language, and I can almost be an interpreter between the two. So if you don't have someone in that role, and I know there are a lot of our JJ facilities have a tech coach. We have a network for those folks as well. But if you don't have someone in that role, someone from your tech department needs to tell the teachers what's happening so they understand some of the user interface on these things change between May and August. So when you, if you don't teach in the summer or you haven't logged into your learning management system in July because you're doing some other type of summer programming, when you log in August, it might look different. And if you're not prepping your teachers for that, that can be a bit jarring for them to, and it creates an uneasy feeling coming back into the August kind of beginning of the school year.
Agreed. I think,
yeah,
having been part of, you know, a number of different technology service organizations, especially focused on schools, you know, communication is not always IT's strong point. And sometimes, that's right. You know, we know we have to update systems and make changes, but we don't always do a great job of communicating how those changes affect the end users. So it's important to have that dialogue.
Yeah, or even really understanding how those effects what that change is doing to the teacher in the classroom. And because the technology people may not even be going into the classroom. So if you're not, that's definitely a good place to start. Spend time in one of the JJ classrooms and really look at how that specific Google Workspace for Education or Microsoft or your content filters or whatever, look at how it's being used by teachers in the classroom before you make those changes. I know teachers would really appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Well, that was just tip one. So what's another tip you can give us to get started for the school year?
So, you know, this is something that's clearly critical and, you know, we'll obviously an inflection point like the start of school year is a good time to do it, but you'd probably want to have an ongoing inventory of your hardware and software. You know, so, you know, where is the hardware in the facility? Who's utilizing it? What software is being utilized? Getting a handle on licensing and whether or not those licenses are being utilized. Obviously, from the standpoint of, you know, making sure that the budget's being used effectively. And then making sure that the hardware is, as far as life cycle, is, you know, usable in a production environment. I know that can be challenging.
When you say, are there programs to help me conduct this inventory and keep this data somewhere? Or am I just creating a Google Sheet or a Microsoft Excel and I'm creating it myself? What's your preferred method?
So obviously, if you have, let's say you have Chromebooks, you do have the admin console to track, you know, the serial numbers and the devices. If you have other types of devices, there are a myriad of different type of inventory programs that you can run on your network to collect information about the devices. You know, the juvenile justice facilities are an interesting case because, you know, the devices aren't leaving the premises, right? They're not leaving the facility for the most part. So you're worrying less about if they're still around, as opposed to, you know, like a public school district where kids might take the devices home and then never bring them back. But yeah, there's so many. I mean, there literally would really depend on what your particular network infrastructure looks like and what types of devices you're trying to track. And those different software applications that will collect information about devices on your network and software on your network. Some of them don't require even an agent to be installed on the endpoint, just does an inquiry across your network and gives you a list of all the different devices and software in use. Others require you to install something on the endpoint, but many different types of apps.
Yeah. And I think too, this really depends on how your facility and educational agency work together. Because, I mean, you know, in different states, they are run in very different ways. So if it's a state-run program, they have a technology department and someone in that department is creating this inventory. It's not, you know, a tech coach or a teacher in an actual facility. But if you're a short-term, you know, county-based facility, it's just the principal and teachers and you're in charge of the devices, then a teacher or a principal or someone is in charge of those devices and needs to be doing this kind of inventory of all of the hardware and software. So I think it also depends on how big and small your program is and sure, who's kind of in charge of and who's purchased those devices.
And again, your role will influence, you know, what type of resources you have available to you as far as collecting that inventory. And, you know, as you mentioned, it could be as simple as just having a Google Sheet or an Excel spreadsheet of,
right,
you know, serial numbers and an associated, you know, person who is been assigned that piece of hardware.
Yeah, this is not a fun tip for me because I have some very non-fun memories of running a one-to-one device program of Windows computers, and you have to physically touch every one and re-image them early on in my career. And I spent many summers stuck in my little cloffice, my little storage room that they cleaned out for me, literally touching hundreds of devices, re-imaging them. And it just took entire summers because I was the only one doing it. And I'm a creative person, and that was not a fun task for me. It just kind of sucked all the creativity out. So it's not a fun tip, but it has to be done.
And there are many, many, many things that you have to do in IT, Kayla, that are tedious and mind-numbing, and re-imaging machines is definitely one of them.
Yes. It's not my favorite thing. No.
No. It's one of the reasons why Chromebooks got so popular. No re-imaging required, that's right?
I can do it all from in minutes almost from, or even maybe a day, not like the entire summer, but I can do it all from my laptop. I don't have to physically take device after device. I'd be in the classroom and just like every desk is covered. The floor is covered. Like I have 50 running at a time. I mean, I got smart with it. You know, I wasn't just taking my time. I was trying to finish it quickly, but there are some tedious tasks we have to get through as tech people. Okay, well, that's two tips. What else do you have for us?
So beginning of the school year is also a great time to vet your user accounts. So, you know, obviously, you know, as people enter the program, then you're creating accounts for them. New employees get hired. But it's a good time to review your user account list and suspend or delete any former employees or students. Because sometimes the priority is, you know, adding new, but not necessarily dealing with former. And so it's, you know, just from a security standpoint, it's very important that, you know, we disable any accounts that are no longer necessary.
Yeah. Do you recommend I mean, you know, our kids are coming in and out of these facilities on a regular basis. I mean, you know, kids go through intake. You could get a new student every day. You could have two new students today and one has left. So, I mean, this could almost be a daily thing where somebody, again, depending on how your program is set up, it's a tech person in a tech department that's run by the state, or, you know, it's someone in your facility. But somehow these accounts are getting created for kids. And as they leave, then they really need to be suspended, maybe not deleted right away. Because I know, especially in a Google Admin Console, if you delete, you're losing data. But if you suspend, that data is still available. So what kind of recommendations do you have for setting up some kind of process where people are checking that or doing that on a more regular basis?
Yeah, I think the idea of process is really important because just from my experience of working with schools over the years, very few schools or districts that I've worked with have a formal onboarding or even offboarding process. I've seen.
And you mean even for teachers, right? Even for employees.
Students, teachers, staff, you know, administrative staff, it doesn't matter. It tends to be fairly ad hoc and not formalized. So maybe the tip might be amended to say, you know, create a formalized onboarding and offboarding process. Because it's not just, right, we mentioned Google and, you know, creating new Google accounts or deleting Google accounts or Microsoft accounts. But, you know, there's obviously many systems that a user might have been added to or need to be added to. So identifying those systems and then formalizing the process for adding and removing them from those systems.
And I know there are a lot of tech people who don't want students to have access. If they're released, you know, they don't want students to have access to their accounts they had when they were inside the facility. And so I do think having a process is important to keep that kind of safety and security in place. Because if we can, you know, I do say a lot of times our tech people lead with no, and I'd really love for them to lead with yes. We try to shift that mentality a little bit, but they have some genuine concerns about keeping students safe and secure online. And so if we create processes like these, that everyone knows, educators, tech people, principals, everybody's aware of the process, everybody's following it as best as they can, that helps keep students safe and secure online, and it helps tech people lead with yes a little bit more often than they might have before, because that safety and security is in place. That's my opinion. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think that there's some additional challenges when we're talking about juvenile justice, because there might be private contractors involved, state employees, you know, facility employees. So there's different groups of individuals that might have to be involved in order for even an account to be created in Google Workspace for a new student. So it complicates matters because you know, kind of have multiple entities that have to be involved. And so it makes the process a little bit more complicated.
Yeah. And again, depending on how you're set up, I know small facilities, there's one principal and, you know, seven teachers, and they run themselves, they've purchased their own devices. Like, that is such a simple system. And I don't mean to say, I'm not demeaning it in any way. It would just be very easy for them, I feel like, in that setting to create this kind of process. Versus right. I'm a statewide program, there's 18 facilities, there's a tech department where tech people don't actually come to the facility. That kind of system is much more difficult to get accounts created, and they have 20-page documents for vendors to fill out and get approved. I mean, there's just all this kind of bureaucracy you have to go through.
Sure, sure. The larger the program, the more, you know, the more hands and the more difficult the process is going to be, because you can create a process and it could be a great process, but it doesn't mean that other entities have to adopt it, right? You may not have the ability to force other entities to adopt your process. So the very least, you know, you have the ability to create a process over what you control, you know, what's in your, so I think that that's valuable.
And we know lots of facilities who are doing this well. So if mm-hmm. you're listening to this and you're thinking, you know, oh, I just don't think this is possible for me, it is possible. You can create these kinds of policies and procedures, whether you're a small program or a large program. And because we know juvenile justice educational agencies that have these kinds of programs in place and they run successfully, they're statewide, they're small individual ones. So it does work, and it does help keep kids safe and secure while allowing us to use more tech in a meaningful way in the classroom. So it is important. And if you're thinking, I really can't do this, reach out to us. We'd be happy to help you kind of problem solve and create some policies.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I think you have, I feel like saying like, and that's not all. Like, I think you have one more tip for us.
Sure. Like I said, this is not an exhaustive list by any means, and we could give you lots of tips, but certainly you want to prioritize cybersecurity. And obviously that means, you know, keeping your applications up to date with vendor patches. But that also means, you know, focusing on the human side of the cybersecurity equation. It means training your end users, which are student and staff, on password management, phishing prevention, and safe and responsible tech use in general.
So no more writing the password down on an index card and hiding it under the keyboard?
You know, as funny as that sounds, obviously that's it sounds awful to think about, you know, passwords being out in the open like that. But NIST, which is you know, a national organization that focuses on cybersecurity, has reiterated that changing user passwords on a rotating basis, like let's say every 3 months, is not a good idea, because that basically, it encourages people to do things like write their password down on a sticky note and stick it to their monitor. So
I think this just came out recently in an article, right? There's their findings of this study is that I just saw it recently, and I was so frustrated because we at Break Free have been talking internally about our own cybersecurity, and we've done some things over the last couple of months to just boost our own responsible tech use. And then they come out and say, you don't need to change your password every 6 months or a year or something, because it is exactly what you just said. It encourages users to write them down, and we maybe don't want that. But so I was thinking, no, we finally get on board with having time to get our own cybersecurity in place. But I do have a question, though,
yes.
And we've talked about this before. What do you recommend for decent passwords? Because there's a lot of information out there. And again, if you're a large educational agency, you might have 200, 300, 400 students. So what type of password are you creating for students that is easy for them to remember, but also not easy that other students will know what it is? This is a pop quiz for you.
Yeah, that's a great question, because obviously when you tell people that they need to have a, you know, a really secure password, they're like, well, what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, how do you define a secure password? My go-to is always creating some sort of phrase. It doesn't have to make sense, but the longer the better. You know, I like passwords that are at least 15 characters long. But really, more important than the complexity or length of your password is multi-factor authentication. MFA is so. You know, part of the study that Microsoft did around passwords and breaches. Accounts that had multi-factor authentication enabled were many, 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 many times less likely to get breached than even an account that had a very long, complex password. So having that, you know, second step of authentication is critical to securing your user accounts. And I know that's a battle that's, you know, been ongoing in education for, you know, probably the last 5 years, is getting folks to comply with multi-factor authentication.
Yeah, because that's difficult. I mean, if you think about an educator in the classroom, in some of these facilities, I can't bring in a cell phone. So, I mean, if you're talking about multi-factor, that means maybe, you know, you're getting a code sent to your phone or you're getting a code sent to your email, or Google, in my opinion, is the worst because it sends you a number you have to tap on your phone. And in all of these cases, it requires you to have two different devices, one of them being mobile. And a lot of our teachers, they can't access a phone in their facility, and it makes it really difficult. So it ends up just getting turned off, you know, for that purpose. So we're really trying to work out what's a good workaround for that so we can have that kind of safety and security in place.
Yes. I know it can be extremely challenging for educators in these facilities because they sometimes can't bring their phone into the classroom. So they lose the capability of, you know, using Google Authenticator or Microsoft Authenticator or some third party authenticator like Authy. There is a workaround to that, and that would be a physical token. So that is a USB or Bluetooth based token that can be utilized in lieu of having, you know, an authenticator generate, you know, a code on a rolling basis. So what I'll say, Kayla, is that security is rarely convenient, but obviously it's necessary. So when we add layers to security, we make things, you know, a little bit, we add friction to the process of maybe logging onto accounts or accessing data. But the bottom line is, without those measures in place, you're, you know, much more likely to experience something nasty like ransomware or an account breach or, you know, data loss through exfiltration. So,
well, thank you for sharing your tips. There's so many places for people to start, but what I'm really hearing you say is we need to be reviewing recent updates to any of the programs like software that we're doing. We need to make sure we're inventorying our devices, hardware, software, all these types of programs. We're monitoring our user accounts, and then we're making sure we're up on our cybersecurity measures. We're doing password management and being responsible for our tech use. Those are kind of my takeaways. That's a lot. So maybe just try one of those.
It is a lot. It is a lot.
And start with one of them. We're going to do maybe just
Have a team. Maybe have a team.
Yeah.
Right.
So don't do it by yourself. Yeah.
Don't do it by yourself. You know, if you have people to help, that's always great.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing those. We're going to do a quick awkward transition here because I'm really excited to tell people about our brand new online community at Break Free called Break Free Base. I, in my role with Break Free, I travel to a lot of these facilities and I meet teachers and principals and ed leaders working in these spaces in person. I provide workshops for them. And what I was hearing over and over and over when I come to teachers and say, you know, hey, you know, how's it going? What do you need? They would say phrases like, I feel so isolated, or I feel so siloed, or do you know any other teacher in the JJ space that teaches math or that teaches this? Because there may be only one English teacher in a facility, you know, and they're not connected to other English teachers in their state, or they don't have a professional learning community. So at Break Free, we've created an online community called Break Free Base, and we're really proud of it. And it just recently launched. So if you haven't signed up for it, please do. What it basically is a social community online. It's like social media, but it's not connecting to any social media server. It's housed on our own domain. So you can find more information at breakfree-ed.org/base. You can go there and sign up for it, but there's all these hubs based off specific roles. So if you are a tech expert listening, we have a tech specialist hub. And so what we can do is post a lot of these things we've talked about in today's episode on there for you. So we'll go on and post where you can get Google for Education workspace updates. We can go on and post where to get your Microsoft updates or the best blogs to follow. You can also get on and talk to other people that are working as a technology specialist in facilities across the country. You can ask questions for trending challenges or share successes. If you create a process for onboarding students and employees and offboarding them, then get on base in your tech specialist hub and share that with other people. So we're not recreating these things at every single facility. We learn better together. So we're really excited about Break Free Base. There's a lot of hubs. There's a lot of content specific for certain roles. So English teachers, our coaches are on there, math teachers, art teachers, special ed coordinators. I mean, there's basically a hub for everyone. And if there's a hub missing, let us know and we'll create one. So we're very excited about Break Free Base and I hope you guys check it out. The URL for that is breakfree-ed.org/base. And any URLs we've talked about today, we'll put below for you in the show notes. We like to close out our podcast with a little bit of inspiration. So, Anthony, I hope you're ready, by talking about our one new thing, which I think one new thing is such an interesting phrase. And that can be something you're excited about implementing. It can be something interesting you've been researching, or just really anything cool you've been wanting to test out. What I believe it is a call to action for us to continuously learn and grow. So I think I have one, but I want you to go first. So, Anthony, what's your one new thing?
Okay. Well, obviously, AI has been like the buzziest of buzzwords the last 18 months. And
I knew you were going to say that.
I know, but hear me out. So maybe okay. I'm going in a direction you're not. There are a lot of tools that are kind of overhyped, and a lot of companies have been guilty of kind of AI washing their products, right? They want to ride that wave of enthusiasm around these smarter tools for working and learning. But for me, the one new thing is these AI-powered personalized learning platforms. So the promise is they're using advanced algorithms and they're analyzing student data, sometimes in real time, and you can then tailor your educational content to meet individualized student needs. Sounds great. It also has the possibility of educators identifying students who might need additional support or enrichment. So some of the solutions that are out there right now that are notable are Dreambox Learning, Newton Alta, Edmentum, and Zurn. And there's probably many, many others. But I think it's something that in the last, I'd say the end of last school year into the beginning of the school year, that there's certainly more and more of these learning platforms that claim to be AI powered and, have all these capabilities of identifying where student weaknesses may be and then, tailoring the resources that the students receive based on that data. So it remains to be seen how effective they are. They're so new. So that really, and for any of the, anybody's listening out there who's had some experience with any of these tools, I'd love to hear what your experience has been. And whether or not you feel like it's really helped your students.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know Edmentum is a popular tool among some of our JJ facilities. And I worry that when AI is involved with Edmentum or similar programs, I don't mean to just call them out specifically, but I feel like then teachers feel like AI is involved and so they don't get as involved. And mm-hmm. we miss some direct teaching that needs to happen in the classroom. And then we become these like credit recovery machines where are kids really learning or are they just kind of clicking through these checklists to get a passing grade on a quiz and then they've received the credit. So I worry that with the introduction of AI, like you're talking about, it's going to make that kind of learning more popular when maybe it shouldn't be, right? That's my concern about AI.
I think I'll show my age a little bit here, and let's go back to the 80s, you know, when synthesizers became a thing in music, right? I think bands went a little bit overboard, right, in using synthesizers. But then eventually it just became another tool, right, to create music with, and it wasn't overwhelming song creation. So, well, it remains to be seen. I mean, you can't escape AI at this point, right? It's basically almost every product you can think of. I'm sure there's some company prepping an AI sponge at this point. They'll collect data on how you wash your dishes, but it's something that we're going to have to live with because it's all around us, and it's only going to be more pervasive, you know, as time goes on.
That's right. I've done quite a few workshops recently about AI, and I named it Authentic AI because, you know, I love technology, but I want tech to be used purposefully. So if you're going to use AI, like, let's have a purpose for it. And there are really cool programs for educators like Magic School AI or Brisk or Diffit. Like, those are the kind of popular ones. But I knew you were going to pick AI for your one new thing. So I did not, because I AI is the trending topic in education now, just across the board, not just juvenile justice, like everywhere. I'm actually proud of some of our JJ spaces for actually like not being a couple of years behind in technology. You know, a lot of times in our JJ spaces, they get tech that's been in public schools for like 3 years already. But there are several that have already implemented programs like Magic School AI. So I've been pretty proud of them on a teacher side. We're not talking about student use, but my one new thing is virtual reality. So this is not new. If I've talked to you in the last year, I've probably mentioned virtual reality because this has been my kind of big project. But what I've been doing is more of an academic side of virtual reality. And what I've really been looking into lately is more of a vocational CTE kind of trade skills type of virtual reality. So I've been looking into different programs, and one notable one is called Transfer VR. We do have, I think there's 3 or 4 facilities that I know of running Transfer VR for students. And it sounds really interesting. So I'm not at a place where I can technically recommend it yet, but I'm still looking into it. That's my one new thing. But it sounds really cool because technically they have a career exploration pathway. So students can put on these virtual reality headsets and, you know, explore different types of careers. You can be an airplane mechanic. You can, you know, be a welder. You can, I mean, just all kinds of these trade skills that they actually get to try out and see which ones they might like. And then there's others where they spend 15 to 20 hours in a specific, you know, trade or field, and they earn certificates and things like that. So that's mine, virtual reality, but not just academic side. I have a program called Class VR that I really love for the academic side. But what can we do with that is a vocational kind of CTE route. That's been my one new thing. Any thoughts on VR quickly before we wrap up?
Just from, you know, an IT support perspective, there's a lot of, when it comes to VR, there's a lot of demand, you know, on the hardware and software, right? It's not the simplest thing to implement, but I think like AI holds so much promise to expand the boundaries of what's capable in the classroom. So it's definitely exciting.
Well, Anthony, thanks so much for joining me on our first ever episode in this tech series.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm really excited. We've got some really great ideas for future podcasts. So definitely keep checking us out. And I'll end by saying that, my friends, is a wrap on our first ever episode of Books Over Bars, a Break Free Education podcast. If you have ideas to share, reach out to us at podcast@breakfree-ed.org. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and are leaving with some aha moments and maybe one new thing to try. Until next time, we hope you create learning spaces that are relevant, meaningful, and engaging for the students in your care. Because when books and learning take precedence over bars, we can drive meaningful change forward. More soon.